The opioid epidemic is the deadliest drug crisis in American history. It results in more than 150 American deaths a day, is the leading killer of people under the age of 50, and has claimed more than 350,000 lives since 1999. The spread of heroin and fentanyl continues to ratchet up the toll, causing tens of thousands of more deaths every year, in addition to those claimed by prescription opioids. So, how did a tragedy that began when Bill Clinton was president and surged through the years George W. Bush occupied the White House only begin to get the attention it deserves when Barack Obama was wrapping up his second term? How was the greatest drug epidemic in American history allowed to go virtually unchecked for nearly two decades with still no end in sight? In his new book, American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts, investigative journalist and Guardian reporter Chris McGreal scrutinizes these questions by calling to account the people Americans look to protect them, yet who catastrophically fail to address the crisis as the bodies piled up year after year. Again, the name of the book is American Overdose, and it's a pleasure to welcome Chris McGreal to the roundtable this morning. Chris, thank you very much for joining us. A great pleasure to have you on the program.
My pleasure to be on the program.
Give us an idea of how you started down this path and looking at this epidemic, this tragedy, and ultimately the three acts of this tragedy.
It began, I was doing reporting for The Guardian, in part about poverty in rural parts of America. And I kept encountering, this is a few years ago, more and more frequently people who were talking about the devastating effects of opioids on their communities. And I started writing about that. And as a reporter, two big questions kind of constantly raised in my mind that I didn't really get a proper answer for. And one of them was why this was an epidemic that had dragged on for nearly two decades, really. It began in the 1990s, and it had grown since then, right through the 2000s, before anybody really started talking about it on a national level, in a nationally political way, which has really only happened in the past two or three years. And the second question that began to haunt me, really, was why was this a largely American phenomenon? If you look at the numbers of opioid painkillers consumed in this country, it's about 85% of all of those manufactured across the world, and yet the United States only accounts for about 5% of the world's population. And so one of the questions that I sought to answer was, you know, did America have a better pain policy? Did it have an epidemic of untreated pain that other countries didn't have? Or was there something else going on here which had led to Americans but not to other people consuming so many pills?
So one of the things that you write about, as you just mentioned, no other country prescribes painkillers in the same level as the United States. So what is it about us that makes that so?
It's the unique circumstances of the origins of this epidemic. There was a group of doctors in the 80s and 90s who saw opioids as a magic bullet for dealing with pain, and they thought that the historic objections by doctors and the medical profession to using morphine and opioids to treat pain were rooted in stigma and ignorance. It had come in part out of an epidemic of opioids in the post-Civil War era, when you had so many soldiers who had been wounded and they needed pain treatment for their wounds. And that had evolved into other people using these drugs, so that by the early 1900s, there was an epidemic of pain and of opioid use in this country that led the government to then appoint an opium czar, of all things, the first one. And he said at the time, he described Americans as the world's greatest drug fiends. Out of that came a very strong, within the medical profession, objection to using these drugs, seeing them as highly addictive and dangerous. That attitude began to change in Britain, of all places, in the 1960s with the rise of the hospice movement, when a doctor, Cicely Saunders, started to argue that morphine could be used to treat those people who were dying, particularly of terminal diseases like cancer and great pain, and that it would bring them a peaceful death. As the hospice movement moved across into the United States, it brought with it the idea that perhaps opioids could also be used to treat chronic pain. And there was a key group of doctors in this country that pushed that idea. They massaged the evidence for it, to be honest. They took quite small studies and made grand claims for not only the effectiveness of the drugs, but also diminishing the dangers, the risks of addiction, and the risks that these drugs themselves can create other medical problems. But the pharmaceutical industry, not being slow to seize an opportunity, spotted this movement and really jumped onto the back of it. And it financed what became a mass movement in the United States within the medical profession to allow the very wide prescribing of drugs, opioids, for all kinds of pain, even down to things such as simple as, my own children had their wisdom teeth removed, and they came home from the dentist with 14 days worth of opioid drugs. That's how widely they were prescribed. And one of the things the drug companies were also able to do, particularly the manufacturer of a drug that's at the center of this, OxyContin, Purdue Pharma, they greatly influenced federal institutions such as the Joint Commission, which licenses hospitals, and essentially persuaded them to make the prescribing of opioids to treat pain and the treatment of pain in itself a priority, so that a movement arose pushing the idea that pain is a fifth vital sign. And as you will probably have noticed, there came a period in the early 2000s when you went into a hospital or a doctor's office and you saw this smiley chart, which you were asked, how bad is your pain? And that pain chart was then used to decide how many opioids you should be given. So there's a whole movement here pushed by the drug industry to get these drugs into people's hands, until by 2010, doctors are writing 240 million prescriptions per year for opioids in this country, you know, one for every adult in the country.
So one of the things that is so fascinating about the book, and I would think would have been one of the biggest challenges in telling this story, is to understand why the regulatory system that is in place failed to ultimately protect the people who were going to see their doctor.
Yes, that's exactly what you would expect, is that the point of federal regulators is to keep a very close eye on the use of these medicines. And as the epidemic and the evidence for the epidemic grew, you would expect them to have intervened. And I think that was one of the most shocking things to me, because when I was trying to answer that question about why this had grown for 20 years largely unchecked, one of the things I discovered was that in the early 2000s, in fact, there were quite a few doctors ringing the alarm bells. They were led, amongst others, by a doctor at Harvard University who headed the pain unit there, and also in its associated hospital, Massachusetts General, a woman called Jane Ballantyne. And she was prescribing opioids according to this new idea that they could be used widely and safely. And she noticed that, in fact, that wasn't working for her patients. She noticed that they were becoming dependent, that often they were in more pain, not less pain, as she increased the doses. And she wrote an article in the New England Journal of Medicine that was published in 2003, that rang the bell and essentially said, listen, we need to pause on this because these drugs are not working as we're being told. And there were other doctors who did the same thing. A surgeon I spoke to, Detroit General Hospital, who was seeing patients die from the use of these drugs post-surgery. And that was a moment at which the Food and Drug Administration and other federal regulators could have put a hold on things and said we need to be much more careful about this going forward. But that's not what happened. The drug industry used its money both within the federal system and within Congress very successfully to essentially change the conversation, to get people to look the other way by saying that people who are becoming addicted are doing so because they're drug abusers. In other words, disparaging them, blaming them for their addiction, really, blaming the victims, and saying over here is this other epidemic of untreated pain, and those are the people you must really concentrate on. And they must not lose their drugs because some people are abusing the drugs. The problem with that argument was that, in fact, often they were the same people, people who began using opioids according to prescriptions, then became dependent and addicted to them, and did end up abusing them because they needed so many a much higher level eventually of drugs than the prescriptions could provide, and they end up buying them on the black market. I think one of the reasons that the FDA failed to step up when it should have was that it is greatly influenced by the drug companies. They have such a close relationship with them, and it's financially dependent on them. In the 1990s, a system began where the drug companies would start paying for the licensing of their drugs. They would pay the FDA, and those fees have risen and become an ever larger part of the FDA's income, and they're now two-thirds of the FDA's income. And I think one of the things that came out of that was, and it was slow, but it evolved into the from a regulator and regulated relationship into essentially a client relationship where the FDA started viewing the drug companies as their clients. If the FDA really wasn't dealing with new drugs in the way that the manufacturers felt they should, the drug makers went round the back of the FDA to Congress, and pressure came from that direction. But also that the FDA and the drug makers often were working in tandem to develop and to test drugs. And so there was this symbiotic relationship where I think the two of them got much, much too close. And that led the FDA, instead of looking at the wider consequences of opioid use and the gathering epidemic, they kept a very, very narrow view of the drugs and whether they were being used as prescribed on the label.
Chris McGreal is the author of the new book, American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in Three Acts. He is a reporter for The Guardian. Let me ask you about the idea of this being an epidemic. And it seems, and this is ultimately going to be a way of asking you the question of where we are right now when it comes to this epidemic, but we're at a point that I don't really know of any. I mean, I have someone in my life, my nephew, who overdosed and passed, and I don't know of any family that isn't once or twice removed from having someone who's been deeply affected by this epidemic, which ultimately, I guess, is why it is an epidemic. So where are we now? Is there anything meaningful being done to curb this problem? And I guess that's another long way of asking the question of, you know, do we have a true understanding of it yet to solve it?
I think we now understand how it happened, and it happened out of the mass prescribing of pills. Even those people who today are overdosing or dying of heroin, 70% of them began on these prescription pills. So we know that the crucible of it is the mass prescribing. I think you're absolutely right about, you know, just about everybody knows somebody now who has been affected by this. I think perhaps one of the reasons that it remained hidden from much of the country for so long is that it began in those parts of America that often aren't seen by the rest of the country, particularly rural Appalachia. And that's no accident. Those are the parts of the world like southern West Virginia, where I spent a lot of time doing this reporting, and eastern Kentucky, where people have hard jobs, very labor-intensive jobs, down mines or logging, and they have for quite a long time used something to hope that help their bodies cope with that, whether it was moonshine or marijuana or painkillers of different kinds. And then these much more powerful opioid painkillers came onto the market, and they were the first really to use them in large numbers. Because the drug companies worked out from sales of other drugs that that's where the market was, they also targeted that for marketing. So there was this this consequence. But because perhaps these are marginalized parts of the community, of the country, the consequences weren't immediately seen to the rest of America. I think when it was... when it then started to work its way into much more middle-class parts of America, you know, into California and Utah and all kinds of other places, then people stood up and took notice. We now know that's the origin. So one of the things that has happened is that there's a scaling back of prescribing, and that's important in stopping a next generation of people becoming addicted. That has consequences for people who genuinely do need these drugs, and there are people for whom they work. They just shouldn't have been prescribed on the scale and as easily as they were. But the scaling back of prescribing definitely is helping to reduce the number of people who are becoming hooked. That's one route. The other, of course, is the people who are already hooked on these drugs, and that is a much harder thing to deal with. With the scaling back of prescribing, you've seen people increasingly use heroin and now fentanyl, which is a very dangerous drug indeed, and which actually is the single largest cause of deaths from opioids over the past year or two. And that requires something much bigger. That requires huge investment in helping people to get treatment, to stay off these drugs, to rebuild their lives, and their families too, because when people are addicted, it's not just them that's affected. It has devastating consequences, particularly for their children, say. So the financial resources for dealing with this are something that is required, and although Congress has voted something towards that, one of the things I noticed in recently reporting from West Virginia was most of the initiatives for the moment are still coming from within those communities, and they're struggling to help people.
You write in the book, it was 2011 when the head of the Centers for Disease Control said that there is an epidemic of opioid addiction in this country. Some of the drugs have stopped selling. Opana, one drug, stopped selling. There have been different states and federal legislation has been passed. But is in that time, it seems like we lost, and maybe I'm wrong on this, but it seems that in that 7 years from the naming of an epidemic, that we lost a lot of people and a lot of time that should have been spent working on the problem.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. And I think it's in part because of this drive by the pharmaceutical companies to keep the floodgates of mass prescribing open on the grounds that to in any way curb it would harm those who need the drugs, who are in chronic pain. And so there was, as I say, there was a deflection. There's a doctor called Nat Katz who has been very vocal on this and had sat on various FDA committees on this. And he said to me that the drug companies always push the idea of a balanced approach. He said that became a euphemism. It wasn't a balanced approach at all. It was an approach to just keep selling drugs. And the idea of the balanced approach was that you would look after both the people who became addicted and the people that were in chronic pain. But he said that the core to that was there mustn't be any curbs on prescribing. We had, as you say, the head of the CDC saying there was an epidemic in 2011, but it took until last year, 2017, for the CDC to be able to push through recommendations that said there needs to be a very significant curb on levels of prescribing. It gave out these guidelines in which he said, firstly, you shouldn't be giving out opioids as the first stop for chronic pain. You should try other things first. And then where you do prescribe them, where doctors prescribe them, they should perhaps prescribe 3 or 5 days instead of what they've been doing, which was 14 or 30 days. And finally, there needs to be a recognition that there has to be a limit on how many drugs you give, because one of the myths that was perpetuated early in this epidemic was that there could be no cap, that you could just keep increasing the dosages until the pain was suppressed, and that the pain would cancel out the risk of addiction. That's patently untrue, and the claims for that were made on the basis of a study of one cancer patient. That's how shaky the evidence was. But that idea took hold, and doctors who are actually trying to do the best for their patients but are often very poorly trained in pain management had no choice but to listen to this advice because they weren't getting any other advice or any other instruction. And so the CDC has finally been able, through its recommendations, as controversial as they've been, to encourage doctors to reduce prescribing. But there was, as you say, that lost 6 years, and that's because of essentially drug company financial pressure and political pressure.
Let us end on this note, which is there's a lot of doom and gloom in this story, obviously, and it is a crisis and it is an epidemic. This story that you tell is not without its heroes, however.
No, and I think that's one of the things that's so striking to me about this is it being America. Lots of people take a personal initiative, and there have been some amazing heroes in this story. One of them is Jane Ballantyne from Harvard, who I just mentioned, who over the years kept up despite the fact that she was disparaged and ignored. She kept up her studies of what the impact of these drugs were. But I think the other people that have been very striking to me are bereaved parents. Many people who've lost sons and daughters to this epidemic have learned from it and determined that others shouldn't suffer the way they did. One way has been to speak out. There's a lot of stigma, as you know, around drug addiction. And you have families from quite prosperous communities where when their children or son or daughter has died from an overdose, they've discovered that other people have suffered the same bereavement but kept quiet about it out of shame. And they've spoken up and they've helped destigmatize it. And they've also often gone out and got changes to the law. There might be local changes, there might be state changes. There's a man called Bob Pack in California who lost his two children to a driver who was using opioids, and she ran over them and killed them. And he was horrified to discover that she had got 3 prescriptions from 3 doctors for opioids all within a few days of each other. And he couldn't believe that you could do that, that doctors somehow weren't recording these prescriptions so they could check that somebody didn't have didn't already have a supply of opioids. And it took him years and years in California to press for what is known as a prescription monitoring system. And it's finally now, 15 years later, coming into effect in California. And doctors are now obliged to check whether a patient already has an opioid prescription. He did that in the face of resistance from all kinds of people, not least the California Medical Association. But he kept it up, and it took him 15 years, and he got there. And so, yes, there are some real heroes to this story.
The name of the book is American Overdose, The Opioid Tragedy in 3 Acts. It is a powerful and very important book. It's published by Public Affairs. Chris McGreal, thank you very much for spending time with us and sharing the story.
Thank you.
Again, the name of the book, American Overdose by Chris McGreal. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.